Hello, welcome to our end of year podcast. If you don't already subscribe, visit churchtimes.co.uk/subscribe to find out our special offers. I'm Sarah Merrick, editor of the Church Times, and I'm here today with Madeline Davis, our senior writer, and Francis Martin, our staff writer. And we're going to look back at some of the key events for the Church of England over 2025. So it's been eventful, I think we'd all agree. And this time last year, just as a reminder, things were feeling pretty fragile. Madeline, take us back.
So we'd sort of dominated the headlines for a period in that we had the Archbishop's resignation, which was a huge national story. We know had an impact on perceptions of the Church of England, so more people describing a negative perception of us. And then I think a huge period of uncertainty about what would happen next. Obviously, the Archbishop of York stepped up into Justin Welby's shoes, but very quickly there were questions about his own safeguarding record, and we saw more calls for him to resign. And there was a lot of uncertainty in that period about whether he would sort of weather that storm. And so that I think there was a sense that we were a bit rudderless, you know, that we didn't have a clear and certain future in terms of our leadership.
And early in the year, I mean, it all seems part of a same sort of wave. We had the resignation of the Bishop of Liverpool.
Yes, so I covered that for Church Times, and that was another big story for Channel 4 News as well. So these were allegations that were made about the bishop in terms of sexual harassment. And these came firstly from a laywoman in the diocese that he'd come from Chelmsford. But there were also allegations from the suffragan bishop, the Bishop of Warrington, in his own diocese. I think one of the challenges there was that there was no formal CDM process. And so these were sort of untested allegations in a sense. But regardless of that, after the Channel 4 item on it, he decided to retire early. And I think there's still sort of uncertainty really about those allegations, particularly from the Bishop of Warrington, who described her frustration about the way allegations had been handled. And so I think there's still sort of a feeling that that is an unresolved scenario, really.
We should say that the Bishop of Liverpool, as was the former Bishop of Liverpool, denies all the allegations, although he did take the decision to retire. So it did also put the Archbishop of York under the spotlight again, because he had been his diocesan bishop in Chelmsford. And in fact, you probably remember this clearly, Francis, from the synod in February. Archbishop Cotterill went to give his presidential address, but beforehand there was a debate suggesting that he shouldn't be allowed to do that. Remind us what happened then.
Yes, and this was really the culmination of everything we've just been describing. Kind of what came to a head really in that moment. And there was various sort of campaigns before the synod and pressure being put on him. And it really sort of came to a crux. And in the end, as sometimes happens in the church, nothing much happened. The vote was passed very convincingly in his favour to allow him to proceed. The presidential address that he had prepared was, I think, fairly well received. It included reflections from other people. It wasn't sort of just him talking. And then the synod kind of got underway, but was, of course, dominated by questions of safeguarding. And the culmination of which was to make this, I think, a decision on safeguarding that wasn't well received outside of the chamber, even though it passed overwhelmingly within it, to kind of take a compromised approach between two different models of the future of church safeguarding structures, which we're going to see sort of the workings out of that potentially towards the start of 2026. As of yet, nothing much has come from that in practical terms. That decision has been made, but it hasn't sort of progressed further.
So what are the stories, Madeline, that stand out for you for 2025? Anything we haven't mentioned so far? What's been big on the agenda for you?
So the one that I think I most enjoyed looking into was the Bible Society's Quiet Revival report, because I think that was a bit unexpected. And so although we'd sort of had anecdotal accounts of an increased openness to faith, to Christianity, to people exploring church, you know, clergy and parishes had been quite surprised by the people walking through the doors. This was a very large piece of polling, which aimed to sort of flesh out those anecdotes with some data. And it did suggest this really significant increase in self-reported church attendance, which was then billed as its quiet revival. It was bucking everything we thought we knew about secularism. And that engendered, I think, a largely very positive reaction in the mainstream press, with journalists very keen to find case studies. You know, who are these people who are suddenly coming to church? I think it was just an interesting idea that perhaps this trend towards secularism, you know, the tide was turning. And so I really enjoyed looking into that. I should say there was a lot of scepticism about it from sociologists. So some of the most sort of experienced sociologists of religion were very wary about the data and said that it was not in line with what they knew. I guess the church's own attendance data didn't point to anything like this, you know, huge increase in attendance. But on the other hand, you know, I was able to speak to clergy who really felt that this resonated with what they were seeing, that they had seen this increased curiosity and people coming not in response to outreach, but, you know, just young men turning up saying, I've been reading the Bible, I've been listening to podcasts, tell me more. I found it quite encouraging to look into, albeit sort of noting the scepticism from some sociologists.
There's some suggestion that even if some healthy scepticism is right, there is nonetheless a sort of a bit of a tide turn in terms of how faith is talked about in the media, for example. It used to be that it was, you know, very, very dismissive as a sort of not something to be taken seriously. But there does seem to be more curiosity in the reporting around this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, so it really sort of made me remember the sort of early part of the millennium when we saw writers like Richard Dawkins become very, very popular. And I remember sort of living through that. I was in my 20s. And I was really conscious as a Christian that the atmosphere was quite hostile and a lot of credence was given to new atheism. And at that point, I'd sort of started doing freelance work for The Guardian, and I would often write about religion. And I used to dread looking at the comments below the line because, you know, they were really ferocious. And I just don't think that we live in that kind of climate anymore. I think new atheism almost became quite embarrassing, you know, more moderate atheists didn't want to be associated with it anymore. And now I think there is more of an openness and a curiosity, particularly amongst younger people who I think don't have the baggage associated with Christianity in the church. It's so alien to them that there's something quite appealing about it. So there's a definite shift.
Their rebellion is rebelling against the sort of atheism of their parents, possibly.
And interestingly, often pursuing quite traditional forms of Christianity. So, you know, people talk about young people want full fat Christianity. I think that needs a bit more explanation, but anecdotally people are saying, you know, they want the weird, they want ritual, they want charismatic worship, you know, they're going for some quite intense forms of Christianity.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what emerges from that. Francis, what about you? What stood out for you in 2025?
I think really kind of relating actually to what Madeline was just saying, the rise of a very visible Christian nationalism, I think, is interesting and maybe has some connections with what we're discussing in terms of the quiet revival. It's a bit louder, and I've heard it described as a dirty revival. A lot of concerns have been expressed, especially by Church of England bishops and figures in the Church of England about the use of Christian symbolism, Christian rhetoric by organisations like Unite the Kingdom, which is, you know, a vehicle of Tommy Robinson, but also perhaps, also, you know, within the mainstream or closer to the mainstream, the Reform Party, who've, you know, shot up in the polls in the course of the last 12 months. So I think that's a fascinating situation that's developing, you know, this idea that people are being drawn to a full fat notion of Christianity, I think, is perhaps mirrored in that. I attended, for reporting purposes, the Unite the Kingdom carol service, as it was billed, on Whitehall just this last weekend. And you can read report from that, my day there and my day speaking with counter demonstrators in the Church Times in this week's issue. And I think it left me with more questions than answers, really. The event was, as the organisers had promised and many people were sceptical about, really was not that political. It was political in the sense it was patriotic, and there were plenty of expressions of patriotism, but it wasn't sort of party political. And there was no mention from the stage of Islam, for example, or of immigration, which are, you know, often the sort of talking points of this kind of movement, and the figures involved, you know, the figures speaking, but they stuck to the to religion, as it were. And speaking to those who were attending, I was fascinated about what had drawn them there. And for many of them, it was a kind of revival of Christian faith and coming to, you know, they were people who had perhaps quite recently started coming to church, had some sympathy with the politics of Robinson, and were drawn to this. And people who have, you know, they have, you know, take no heed of what the Church of England bishops say. So they weren't sort of put off by that. In fact, if anything, I think perhaps the condemnation by Church of England bishops encouraged some people to go, to think that, you know, if this is, you know, if it's essentially an anti-establishment movement, the Church of England represents the establishment. Therefore, you know, this proves that we're doing something important, something right. But also talking to people, you very quickly got the sense that this was part of a bigger, one of the sort of symptoms, perhaps, of really difficult times, difficult economically, difficult socially. You know, there's people there. One man told me, you know, he when his grandchild is born later this year, the first thing he's going to do is apologize to his infant grandchild because he's, you know, because the state the country is in. And some of this is kind of wrapped up with perhaps conspiratorial thinking about sort of the way the world works, et cetera, et cetera. But at the very heart of it is a kind of sadness and a frustration. And I think what's going to be fascinating is to see how the church responds to that and whether it continues to take a fairly uncompromising line that we might sort of interpret the condemnation before the event last week, or whether it perhaps tries to engage more with those people, of whom there seem to be a fair number, who are drawn to that particular expression of Christianity. So I think it's a fascinating story that's developed in this sort of second half of this year, and I think it's going to be a huge one to follow in the year to come.
A story that's been running for a lot of this year is the assisted dying bill, and that's now in the House of Lords. You've been following this closely, Francis. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, I have. And again, it's another one that's going to keep running into next year. It's currently in the House of Lords. The bishops have been extremely prominent in their opposition to it, and univocal, really, in their opposition to it. And I think we're going to see, you know, it passed by a relatively small margin in the House of Commons. It's unclear exactly where the sort of votes lie in the House of Lords. A member of the House of Lords I was talking to recently told me that while it, you know, in the actual debates, it's very clear that the majority oppose it. Those are only the people who are turning up for the debates. And there's, you know, there's a lot of members of the House of Lords who very rarely turn up, but will turn up for a vote. So when it comes to a vote, it is possible that it might still pass in the House of Lords in its, you know, relatively unamended form. But I think what's really gearing up here is to see some sort of constitutional clash between the Commons and the Lords. And especially, you know, given the government sort of in effect supports the bill, at least we know that the current Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, supports the idea of a change to the legislation, even though he's given MPs a free vote on it. So I think we could see a sort of development of the those constitutional questions of what powers the Lords really have to go against the Commons and to stymie legislation coming through their house. And the perception of the bishop's role in that process will be fascinating to observe.
And I think that might be might have an effect in the future of the bishops in the House of Lords, which is something that is always rumbling on, and Labour particularly is always talking about and never quite gets round to the reform. So, yes, we'll have to watch that one. Madeline, we started the year, as you said, with no Archbishop. On the Feast of Epiphany, Justin Welby laid down his crozier. And then in October, we had the announcement of the new Archbishop. Talk us through that story and how that emerged.
Yes, so I think there was a huge amount of speculation and a lot of people expressing frustration that it was taking so long to occur. So in fact, you know, it wasn't taking a particularly long time if you look at the processes, but because we had this sudden resignation, it felt like this huge weight, and then people were comparing it unfavourably to the conclave. So there was what felt like a long wait. Then we had all the speculation about who it was going to be, because I think this whole concept of the CNC as a confidential process sort of baffled many people outside the church. You know, how can we not know even who's on the shortlist? And then obviously we had the announcement of our first female Archbishop of Canterbury, which I was a bit surprised didn't get more attention, because having covered the women bishops debate, you know, in 2012 to 2014, I think back then, if we'd have said, you know, within a fairly short period of time, we'll actually have a female Archbishop, that would have been, you know, a huge story. But perhaps that just points to how normal women bishops have become in the Church of England. And we've, you know, quite quickly as a country adapted to that. I think there was a lot of interest in her background, because she was this chief nursing officer. So she was coming in with a huge amount of professional experience outside the Church of England. And I think she draws on that a lot. So she'll talk about how in both professions she's ended up washing people's feet, and that, you know, at heart she'll always remain a nurse. And I think that's very interesting as well, to have come from that profession, which I think many people often feel is sort of undervalued in the country. You know, it's a job largely done by women. It's not very well paid. She doesn't have the sort of private education or Oxbridge background of many bishops. So I think she's a very interesting choice in that sense as well. And I guess sort of, as was expected, we did have a reaction from more conservative parts of the communion. But I think in a way that was more focused on the perception that she has a liberal stance on sexuality rather than her gender. And perhaps that is now the crucible of our debates in the Anglican Communion would be, you know, where will she take the journey on LLF?
And we should say that even as we speak, there are rumblings around whether she is fit for office. Tell us where we're up to on that.
Yes. So we're sort of speaking the morning after a two-part investigation on Channel 4 into Bishop Sarah's background in terms of the handling of safeguarding allegations. In this case, particularly the case of Father Alan Griffin, who took his own life. And a coroner's report which looked into that was extremely critical of the way the Church of England had handled his case. So that is being brought up again, and I guess drawn into wider attention. Many in the church will be very familiar with this case, but probably not at the country at large. And it's looking at how she handled that case. And I know there's going to be another aspect broadcast this evening, which will have an interview with a former diocesan safeguarding advisor in the diocese who also has concerns about how safeguarding in London has worked.
But we should say all of this was known to us beforehand. Yeah. And was presumably known to the CNC. So we'll just have to see what happens there.
Yeah,
but it's not as if it's new.
She did say in her statement to Channel 4, you know, it's understandable that now that she's got this appointment, there will be a lot of scrutiny of her record. So I think there's a sense in which she anticipated this coming up. The diocese had a very long statement prepared. We saw Bishop Joanne Grenfell, who was her suffragan, offer quite a robust defence of working with her and her safeguarding record. So I think this is something that the church was very prepared for.
In that respect, perhaps it really differs from the resignation and the build-up to the resignation of Archbishop Justin Welby this time last year, or just before this time last year. It does feel like that this has been prepared for, and perhaps, you know, that there is going to be a concerted effort to avoid a resignation because of, you know, it really would spell chaos once again.
So thinking a bit more widely than internal church affairs, Francis, you had the experience of visiting Israel-Palestine a few weeks ago with the Archbishop of York. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, I mean, it was an extraordinary trip. It was particularly extraordinary to be visiting after writing about it for so long and not having been able to go for various sort of security reasons. The last time I'd been there was just before October 7th, 2023. So I was able to see how things had changed. It was in some ways the best of times and the worst of times as a journalist. It was extraordinary to see the courage and resilience of people living there, particularly Anglican communities in the West Bank, who are you know, a minority within a minority, in some respects, have felt that their voice has not been heard many times, and who, you know, were very, very appreciative of the Archbishop of York for visiting. He was very cognizant of this fact and apologized for some of the church's statements at the, especially in the early, you know, a few weeks after the October the 7th attacks and the start of that particular bombardment of the Gaza Strip. So it was, in some respects, kind of heartening to see the Anglican Communion functioning in the way that I think it was, you know, many hope to see it functioning, envisioning it functioning, especially when we're quite often writing about the ways it's not functioning. The other side of that, of course, is that it's a really, really difficult situation that people there are facing. And we saw that firsthand, the presence of armed settlers in Palestinian communities in the South Hebron Hills, who, you know, arrived very, you know, I would say shamefacedly, but without any sort of shame at all, but with balaclavas covering their face to intimidate the international delegation that was visiting this Palestinian village, the Archbishop of York leading that, you know, blocked in the van. You know, there wasn't, I think, a sense that we personally felt at danger, but you were also very conscious of the fact that just a couple of months before, a Palestinian man had been shot by a settler on camera, and that settler, you know, was briefly placed under house arrest and then released by a judge who decided he'd been acting in self-defense. So, you know, you're aware of the bloodshed, literally the bloodshed, on this land the whole time you're there. And then very shortly after that, on another visit, you know, just half an hour later, the police arrived, the Israeli police that, you know, effectively control large parts of the West Bank, and told the Archbishop of York that, you know, we had to move on. This was now a closed zone. Again, you know, there's no way of checking that. There's no way of sort of proving that or disproving that. You know, the way that the system works is you have to do what the people who have guns tell you to do, in by and large. And so it was a really clear example of the difficulties that people there are facing. And I think that subsequently heavily informed the Archbishop of York's statements when he returned back to the UK.
And he used the words apartheid and ethnic cleansing.
Yes. So to describe the West Bank, yeah. Apartheid and ethnic cleansing were the terms he used. Referring to this, you know, specifically in Area C of the West Bank, where, as I described, you know, you've got it's the Israeli military and Israeli civil authority hold sway, but there is this sort of huge settler movement, some of which is legal under Israeli law, but not under international law. Some of which is illegal even under Israeli law, and that was the context of the shooting in the village we visited. So what you're seeing. And what he was trying to describe was people effectively being forced out of their land because of their identity. In reference to Gaza, he talked about genocidal acts. I think that got more pickup because the word genocide always gets, you know, pick up. And the question of is there a genocide in Gaza has been one of the, you know, most fiercely contested semantic discussions of the last year. We've seen various kind of UN bodies, for example, describing it as genocide, and we've seen, you know, the Israeli government very fiercely rejecting that idea, and the UK government kind of coming down on that side of the argument as well. He specifically said genocidal acts rather than a sort of campaign of genocide. But I think, you know, the toughening up of that language reflected what he witnessed and the conversations he had with people there, you know, which included rabbis as well as Palestinian Christians, as well as Palestinian Muslims. So included a wide range of people and church, you know, other church leaders from other denominations in Jerusalem. So, yeah, it was the trip was fascinating. It was interesting to see how, you know, these trips work in that environment and to see how the Church of England is perceived outside of England, which is very different to how it's perceived, I think, in this country.
So that was 2025. Let's look ahead. Madeleine, what do you think the big stories of 2026 will be?
So obviously we've got the installation of the 106th Archbishop of Canterbury. So that will be a huge event for the country, I think, particularly because she's a woman. And I think there will be a fresh round of commentary in the mainstream press, and no doubt sort of more profile pieces about Sarah Mullally. I also think sort of internally within the church, we'll be seeing how she leads the institution. And I think going in, she's talked a lot about the need for internal reform. So I don't expect that will pick up many sort of headlines in the mainstream press. But I think as a church, we can anticipate some changes under Archbishop Mullally, who has talked about coming in for another organisation and regarding, you know, many aspects of it perhaps as not fit for purpose in terms of how we govern, levels of accountability. I know she's talked about safeguarding needing to be, you know, completely reset. So it will be interesting to see how she leads us, I think.
And Francis, what's on your radar for next year?
I think the Living in Love and Faith process, which has been going on for a long time, is going to really, well, some nettles have to be grasped. I think to some extent they were this year, but to give that a little bit of context, the two kind of outstanding issues, as it were, that are being contested, which is the introduction of standalone services of blessing for same-sex couples rather than the use of prayers within existing services, and a change to the rules that currently prevent clergy from being in a same-sex civil marriage. Those were two changes that were, I think, more widely expected to be introduced, and in standalone services were voted for at least a trial period by the Synod previously. Both of those have slowed. We saw in the early summer, we saw the resignation of the Bishop of Leicester as the lead bishop for LLF, seemingly over an inability to get a consensus on the way forward amongst other bishops, particularly on the idea of some structural change and delegated episcopal ministry, a kind of, you know, structural change perhaps broadly comparable to the resolution reached on women bishops. And just yesterday we were expecting the House of Bishops to approve the decisions announced in October to basically push the standalone services and same-sex marriage for clergy back to synod, requiring a higher level of majority, which everyone knows that with the current makeup of synod they won't be able to achieve, which was, you know, met with great dismay by those campaigning for greater inclusion, who saw this as effectively the end of the LLF process and felt that, you know, insufficient progress had been made and promises hadn't been kept. It was slightly curious that yesterday the bishops announced that instead of sort of formally approving these plans, they were going to take a bit longer to think about them. You know, it perhaps wasn't, we shouldn't be surprised by decisions being deferred. It does tend to happen quite a lot, especially in the House of Bishops. So now we're waiting to see what they come forward with in January. There's some suggestion I've heard that it may actually be, you know, it might be ossifying in a slightly more conservative direction rather than a more liberal one, which, you know, there was a lot of pressure on them, at least publicly, to push for. And we also know that the Alliance, which is a network of churches that are broadly opposed to these changes, have also been kind of, you know, putting pressure on the bishops, lobbying the bishops. So, you know, they're being, you know, the tussle of LLF continues, and at some point some decisions have to be made and stuck to. And it's possible we're going to see that sort of come to a head in February synod. But as ever, there's always a possibility of further delay. So we'll wait and see.
So there'll be plenty, I think, to be filling our pages and our website for 2026. Keep in touch with what's going on by following the churchtimes.co.uk or subscribing to the paper. Francis, Madeline, thank you.